SLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Noah Bookstein with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, May 26th. Florida's budget fight is over. House and Senate leaders struck a deal late Sunday night on a nearly $115 billion spending plan for the fiscal year starting July 1st. The agreement came during a special session. The second year in a row, lawmakers couldn't finish the budget on time. The regular session ended in March without a deal, with House Speaker Daniel Perez pushing for deeper cuts over fears of future deficits. The final number splits the difference between what each chamber wanted. Legislators are expected to formally approve the budget Thursday and send it to Governor Ron DeSantis. Nathan Benderson Park is set to receive a major state investment of $10 million in the budget to build a massive new indoor sports complex if the governor signs off. The proposed 100,000-square-foot facility would house courts for different sports and could double as a museum or event space. The facility would also serve as a disaster shelter and evacuation center. Local Republican lawmakers say after hurricanes hammered the region last year, the area needs a dedicated emergency hub. The project has a $45 million estimated cost and carries broad support, clearing both chambers. Some residents say the massive building would use lands better preserved for the park's original mission as a rowing venue that can host Olympic trials and rowing competitions as it has been doing since 2009. The Adagio Towers, a luxury housing development proposed under the Live Local Act, received partial sign-off from the city's Development Review Committee on its fourth attempt. The project would bring a mix of market-rate condos and attainable housing to a 2.2-acre site near Burns Court. A total of 189 residences are planned for the site, with 113 units in one tower at market rate and another smaller tower containing 76 units said to be attainable. Currently, one of the parcels contains a 1924 automobile garage, the oldest of its kind in Sarasota, that preservationists are now preparing to fight for in court. The U.S. is escalating pressure on Cuba. U.S. officials indicted 94-year-old former Cuban President Raul Castro. They also sent the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier and its strike group to the Caribbean as the situation is worsening on the island. There are also daily blackouts that have knocked out clean water, refrigeration, and communications throughout Cuba. The American government subpoenaed American citizens who participated in a humanitarian convoy to Cuba in March. As many as 40 Americans are under review. In South Florida, long lines have formed outside shipping businesses in Little Havana as Cuban Americans rush generators, canned goods, and supplies to relatives on the island. This has been Noah Bookstein with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, May 26th.
Listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 88 of our Changing Environment. The previous show was Melody Matrix, hosted by Neil.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm Jonna Miller, and we're doing something different that we've never done before. We're pre-recording the show on May 18th at a meeting of the Serenoa chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society, held at Sobey Gardens here in Sarasota.
WSLR's program director, Leanne Kerber, got here early and set up the recording equipment. During the intervening week, we will edit the file, and the edited show will be broadcast on May 26th. Meanwhile, we have a live audience outside the WSLR studio.
We're joined by two special guests, Bree Anderson and Lee Amos. Bree is the Land Acquisition Coordinator for Sarasota County's Land Acquisition and Management Program, overseeing acquisitions of environmental and parkland properties. We'll be talking with her about the program and the upcoming referenda on extending that program.
But first, we're going to talk with Lee Amos. Lee is the Director of Land Management and Environmental Programs at the Ellen Hodge Center in Baymont.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own, do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Lee, you were on our show recently, but we wanted to hear more about some of the real-world challenges of land management in the 21st century. Let's start with the longleaf pines of Pine Island and where they may be headed.
Okay, thank you very much. So yeah, just by way of introduction, so I'm a conservation biologist and I've been working the past 16 years in land conservation and land management, recently joined the Hyde Center to develop their environmental program. And over the years, I've spent a lot of time restoring wild habitats, wildlife, and that process really begins with planting the right plants and getting the right plant community, getting the plant community sort of in order. And probably our most common forest type here is pine flatwoods. And the tree in that habitat is some type of southern pine, either slash pine, South Florida slash pine, or longleaf pine. Longleaf pine actually reaches the southern limit of its range in Lee County, so two counties south of here. And it goes northward up through the southeast. It's a southern pine in the U.S. And the trees down in Lee County are kind of unusual. They're shorter, scragglier, growing on this island with very little soil, the limestone's near the surface, experiencing hurricanes and floods and fire. It's just this very harsh environment. I think the flooding in particular is pretty unusual. Longleaf is usually in drier conditions. So it's managing land down in Pine Island with longleaf pine, having to restore and plant trees. And, you know, I had the choice, where am I going to get trees from? And when you acquire these trees, typically they're coming from nurseries in North Florida. And what we know from pine research from decades is you don't take northern pines and plant them southward. You can take southern pines and plant them northward. And this started a whole thing where then I started collecting seeds from local trees, propagating them, and then planting them on the island and distributing them to partners north of the island. The whole idea here is just to try to find genetics from trees that are adapted to these conditions and will be adapted to future conditions. So just imagine that as the climate gets weirder, it becomes hotter, the rain events, the storm events become more extreme, it'll be even more important for trees to be adapted to these harsh conditions. So yeah, we've been, for about a decade, I've been collecting seeds, propagating them, and distributing them to partners.
So are you aware of other species where people are doing that?
So I've heard about this in context, I think, out west. I don't hear much about it in Florida. I do know partners, you know, Maurice Olivetano Gardens, Bach Tower Gardens, working on endangered species, plants of conservation concern that are listed. You know, working with common trees, I hear less about. I have other trees that I'm starting to key into, but I don't know of people also working on this.
So are you working independently on this?
In terms of longleaf pine, so I partner with the Heartland Longleaf Implementation Team, which is coordinated by the Nature Conservancy and consists of partners, not-for-profits, government agencies, working together to manage longleaf pine and like kind of south of Ocala. And so we're working together, and in terms of propagation, I have some local nurseries that I work with. Sandhill Nursery in Arcadia has been a really great partner over the years.
So in addition to Sandhill Nursery, where else are you propagating these?
And then we also now are propagating them at the Elling Eye Center.
Okay,
so
great.
We're starting a conservation horticulture program there.
Yep.
So I've been reading recently the ponderosa pines are having trouble and getting the next generation being stressed, and I think they're facing a similar problem. So how far north have some of the seedlings you've propagated ended up going at this point?
The farthest north that we've planted longleaf pines is Duet Preserve,
okay,
Manatee County.
All right. And are people seeing signs of stress in longleaf from too much heat?
Not that I've heard of.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is pretty anticipatory.
It is.
Okay.
Yep.
So, Lee, are you planning to do any burning of the oak scrub?
At the Allen High Center, we do have multiple natural community types along Little Sarasota Bay, and the most common type there is oak scrub. We also have some scrubby flatwoods, and both of these communities are fire-dependent, pyrogenic communities, so the plants that grow in them produce a lot of oils that want to burn. They promote fire, and when the habitat burns, it also helps the plants and animals thrive. If you don't burn, over time, you will lose these plants and animals. You're probably used to seeing, you know, scrub habitat or pine flatwoods, maybe not by name, but you'll see these places that are just tall, thick, soft palmetto, and that's an unburned habitat. When you bring fire back, the structure opens up, you get a lot of sun to the ground layer, and a diversity of plants will grow there, and that feeds wildlife in abundance. So we want that at the Ide Center, and to get that, we'll have to return fire, prescribed fire specifically.
So this is good for gopher tortoises, right?
It is essential for gopher tortoises. They will completely disappear without it.
Yeah.
And if you see a gopher tortoise in these unburned places, you might think, oh, they're happy. Well, they're survivors. So this is like you'll see a 60-year-old tortoise who's been surviving. And they were born a long time ago when there was still fire on the landscape. You don't see many juveniles. And really, it's, you know, you want to judge the community by the health of all stages, including the young.
So what are the challenges you're facing in reintroducing fire?
Sure. So, you know, in an urban context, you have to be like super, super doubly safe, but also you're often avoiding just conflicts of smoke. So we can't put smoke towards any homes. There are people that are especially vulnerable. They might have some kind of breathing conditions. So nursing homes, you really can't put smoke towards. So one challenge is we'll have to burn this preserve only on an east wind, which can put smoke out, you know, loft over Little Sarasota Bay, which is definitely a limiting factor.
And so you have a conservation easement on the Ide Center?
We have a conservation easement on part of it. It's a 72-acre preserve. Mm-hmm. 14 acres was preserved by Sarasota County in 2024 in partnership with Big Waters Land Trust and the Ide Center.
And the ability to burn the oak scrub on your property will make it possible for Bayoun Preserve to do a burn there, right?
It is going to help. So just north of the Ide Center is a conservation preserve owned by Sarasota County called Bayoun Preserve, and it is open to public access. The Ide Center is closed to public access as a research preserve. And, you know, the Bayoun Preserve is surrounded by even more conflict. So if they were to ever be able to burn their property, and that's an if, they would really need to burn it on a north wind, putting smoke and heat towards our property, which we would be very open to. But for that to be a safe thing, we'll have to get our property completely burned. And, you know, really, without going into the whole talk about prescribed fire, you know, essentially you're trying to put heat towards areas that have already been burned or can't burn. So you burn first towards water, and then you burn the other areas towards what we call black or ash. If it's already been burned, it can't be burned again.
So tell us about the recent BioBlitz.
Yeah, I was so happy with this BioBlitz. So we held this May 2nd at the Ide Preserve. And the whole concept was, with this private research preserve, it's not open to the public. And yet, it doesn't feel right for the gates to be closed all the time. Not only does the public want to be there, but we want them to come visit it. The trick is figuring out, how do we engage them in the research mission in a way that's right for the property and right for the activities there. So the concept we came up with was the BioBlitz. We invited the public out for a day of documenting and observing organisms on this property using the app called iNaturalist. We invited guests. We got about 70 people to show up. They documented over 1,700 observations and 450 species at last count. Those species will increase over time as contributors, like people in this audience, continue to identify those observations. And it's a lot of excitement and a lot of just a great way to learn. You know, if you don't know what you're looking at, you can use this app and it'll help you identify, and that opens up a whole world of understanding what's around you. So I feel really good about the engagement and everything we learned that day.
So going back to Longleaf for a second. So some people may be aware of Bee Island in Mackers River State Park, but if people want to leave here and see the closest Longleaf, where would you send them?
From Selby Gardens?
From Selby Gardens.
That's a great quiz. There used to be some over by Twin Lakes Park, Clark Road, on the north side of Clark, but that's now developed.
Okay.
I don't know if Twin Lakes Park has any, but it's not. I'm not aware of longleaf pine on the coast in Sarasota County until you get down to Inglewood, Woodmere. So South Venice still has some scattered pines around Woodmere. Sarasota, if you go out to Old Myakka,
yeah,
that's a longleaf population there.
There's a bunch at Lakewood Ranch or Shader Manatee that took care of. Anyone in the audience have thoughts about
it? So here's the answer. Curry Creek Preserve in Venice would, I think, be the easiest to see, and Pinebrook Park in Venice.
Okay. And for those who are listening, how would people go about distinguishing longleaf from slash?
Maybe a little bit tricky.
Yes, that's why we're asking.
Because the diagnostic is a little hit and miss, but essentially you're going to find a tree that you think might be a longleaf and pick up pine needles underneath it, and you're looking for the little collection of needles wrapped in like a paper sheet. That little bundle, you're looking for bundles of three in a longleaf pine. A slash pine will have twos and threes, and any longleaf bundle could have always dropped a needle accidentally. So it's not, you're going to kind of pick up lots and lots of needles, and if you're getting like 99 that are three, and there was only a couple that, you know, out of 100 that were a two, then you can be reasonably sure that's a longleaf pine. But a slash pine is going to be like 2-3, 2-3, 2-3. It'll kind of flip-flop.
I try to go by the twigs. I was taught the twigs are more like pinkies on the slash and more like thumbs on the longleaf.
You know, there's just so much genetic variation and variation of morphology that I find it to be a little bit tricky for the average person. But you're right, that is generally true. Now, the longleaf cones are typically larger, supposed to be larger, but I've seen slash pines with larger cones than longleaf. The scales on the cones of the longleaf are actually noticeably larger than the scales on the slash, but it can be a little bit tricky.
So do people have, question?
I was just wondering, so is there like not enough of these pines around? Like, people should be planting more of these, or? I don't know, I've got 3/4 of an acre, so I'm trying to see what is best to put on here.
Yeah, overall, longleaf pine was kind of wiped out in the southeast, so we're at 3% of the historic population size. So I think that is a need. When I think about planting trees, you know, first you think about what was there naturally. So on your property, I would try to figure out what was there naturally, and the answer might be slash pine, right? So then you might decide you want to plant both trees. The benefit of that is, one, it's fun, and two, you're increasing the diversity. So you might get a little difference in value to wildlife. The cones are going to ripen at different times. You know, different caterpillars might eat the tree a little bit differently, and they're going to be differently resistant to stressors, outbreaks of disease. They might behave differently. So you're kind of putting your eggs in multiple baskets when you plant more species rather than just one.
I have a question about the alternative to burning, and it's just more of a curiosity because I'm aware of a preserve area just south of the Benderson Park inside Highway 75, and it's surrounded by residences, and so what they did is they came in and they just brought in a grinder, they ground everything and just saved an area where there was the tortoise, and they said that was just like as if it had been burned, and I kind of doubted it. I was just curious if there's
something. So the question essentially is mechanical reduction of vegetation with like a tractor and a grinder on it, is that the same as a fire? The answer is it's not the same. You know, the plants actually respond to heat and smoke in ways that the mechanical treatment just can't replicate. And then, of course, when you grind up the material, you're putting organic material down the ground. You're essentially mulching that habitat. So that mulch in the garden suppresses the growth of weeds. And the natural habitat is suppressing the growth of the wildflowers and grasses that you want to grow for the tortoise and all the pollinators and so forth. So it's kind of a negative. And that organic material also, you know, when you have organic material in that sandy soil, it makes the conditions more favorable to exotics. So you find that the native species are well adapted to the nutrient poor soils. And it's an easier habitat to manage when it's like almost sterile. You know, it's like quartz sand and it's hard thing to grow. You add that mulch and it changes the picture.
So Lee, what about going in and grinding to change the fuel structure and then coming back with fire and burning the
And that's often what's done. So okay. in a situation where, so your fuel height, like the height of a salt palmetto is gonna, if it's a high fuel height, it makes for like a dangerous burn, so to speak. So you can come in with a tractor and smush that down essentially, and it's just like in your backyard when you make a little fire. If you step on the sticks, like it'll make it kind of smolder. And that's a much easier, safer burn. So you'll do the mechanical treatment first and a burn afterwards.
Let me introduce our guest today, Bree Anderson. Bree is the Land Acquisition Coordinator for Sarasota County's Land Acquisition and Management Program, overseeing acquisitions of environmental and parkland property. We'll be talking with her about the program and the upcoming referenda on extending the program. Lee Amos is the Director of Land Management and Environmental Programs at the Ellingide Center in Vemo. The Fruitville Library in Sarasota County is temporarily closed for renovations. A portable library with limited services and amended hours is open in the library and number 39 parking lot, so patrons can maintain access to materials during construction. Renovations are scheduled to be completed by July of 2026. More information is available at sarasotacountylibraries.org.
Okay. So, Bree, in less than half a year, Sarasota voters will decide whether to fund a program to protect additional preserved land, parkland, and also agricultural land in Sarasota County. Since the year 2000, the Florida Forever program has protected over 1 million acres of land in Florida, which is out of about 42 million acres total. But rather than using football fields, I'd just say the Florida Forever program has protected about 3 Sarasota counties at the state level. And I can't even begin to think about what our quality of life would be like without Oscar Scherer Park and Mack River State Park. These are really crucial things we have here in Sarasota County. Because they couldn't agree on a budget, the legislative session's cranking up again. And the House is proposing $0 for the Florida Forever program. And the Senate has $50 million, but only for conservation easements, not for straight-up land acquisition. And that's through a program called the Rural and Family Lands Protection Program. So we started to get into this, but could you explain a conservation easement, which is what we'd be getting with rural and family lands, and how that compares from buying land outright?
Sure. Thank you both for having me, Julie and John. So the land acquisition program that I manage involves two programs: Environmental Sensitive Lands Protection Program and the Neighborhood Parkland Program. And the Environmental Sensitive Lands Protection Program's goals are to focus on rarity of species, quality of habitat, connectedness, natural resources, manageability. And so we try to protect land that consists of native habitat, and therefore habitat that can accommodate native wildlife, and also provide for public recreation. So there's a two-pronged approach there, the benefits to the public, but also the environmental benefit. We not always can purchase land for public access, and that's where the conservation easements come into play. So in the last 25 years, the program has protected over 42,000 acres. 22,000 have been through conservation easements. And there are 13 properties, including the Ellingide Center and privately, as John mentioned, that have protective statuses through conservation easements. And what essentially those are negotiations to purchase the development rights from the property owner. The property owner retains ownership of the property. They continue to use the land, such as cattle ranchers, but they're giving up the development rights, and that's what the negotiation involves. So it goes through quite an arduous process to draft the conservation easement deed, then determine the value of the rights that they're giving up, which is typically a fraction of the fair market value, negotiate that purchase price and contract, and then close on a conservation easement. And those development rights are extinguished, which means that the county is paying essentially for the land to be protected, but the nice benefit to the county is that the county is no longer on the hook to manage the property as we would normally do so in a land repurchase fee simple. So the conservation easements that the Rural Manly Lands Protection Program are proposing and have been doing for a number of years are essentially protecting agricultural lands for continued use in agricultural ways such as cattle ranches, but extinguishing those development rights. And the Rural Manly Lands Protection Program partners with local agencies to combine resources for funding and for enforcement purposes to allow that conservation easement to go into place, but also to be able to jointly fund and manage.
So would you say a fraction? Are we talking a third, a half, two-thirds? How much do the conservation easements typically cost?
Oh, they range. It depends on the quality of the property, the size, and the location. In rural communities, the range can be anywhere from 30 to 65% of the full market value. Of course, you have to consider what rights the landowner is giving up. The more rights they give up, the more value they'll receive financially. The more rights they retain, the less they'll receive in compensation. If you're looking at more suburban, urban, and coastal environments where the highest and best use may not be conservation land, then typically a value could be even as close as 80% of the market value of that property.
So if, let's say that the legislature does fund or put more money into the Rural and Family Lands Program, how might that benefit Sarasota County?
Oh, yeah. Well, good question, Alan. Thank you. So we are currently working with the Rural and Family Lands Protection Program to protect about 3,000 acres east of I-75 along State Road 72 corridor between Cowpensloo and Mayaca River State Park. It's known as Hawkins Ranch, and it's one of the last remaining tracts of land that is undeveloped and is an operating cattle ranch since the 1880s. And we're looking to partner with the Rural and Family Lands Program to fund the protection of that property through an easement. There are other properties in Sarasota County that we've also identified for Rural and Family Lands Program as well, and that will continue as long as those funds are available.
So what's your prognosis or prediction? Do you think that's likely to happen?
I do.
Okay, that'd be great. Are there other, I know we've acquired, as you said, a significant acreage of conservation easement lands. To what extent have other state or federal entities been helping to pay for that?
For conservation easements, other than our own funding program through the referendum, we had partnered with SWIFTWAD, the Southwest Florida Water Management District, to fund four different conservation easements, all in eastern part of the county, along our State Road 72 corridor. And they have funded about $63 million worth of projects for us. They have also done some fee simple purchases for them as well.
Yeah, Deer Prairie Creek was a joint acquisition?
Yes, Deer Prairie Creek is a little over 6,000 acres along the Mayaca River between Border Road and U.S. 41 on the east side of the river, and that is a jointly owned and managed and funded property that was purchased back in the early 2000s with Swift Money.
Yeah, having two owners is sometimes valuable. It's sort of like when that in the movies where they have to turn two keys to launch the missiles. Having two interests helps reduces the likelihood that you get one bad board or one bad commission who wanted to do something stupid, and the odds are that the hope is the other one will be saner and keep things going. So I support those situations. In your experience, though, and you've been doing this for a while, are we, I mean, my perception is we're seeing a reduction in the state level commitment for land protection. Is that, would you agree with that?
I would agree.
Yeah.
But I have been hopeful that next year we'll see some changes.
Okay. Let's do what we can to make that happen. Now, here's a question I got from someone, I don't remember where, but if this is not a tax increase, why is it on the ballot? Why are we voting on this if we're not voting to increase taxes?
So citizens of Sarasota County already pay this tax. It's a quarter mil rate, you know, ad valorem taxes, and it's just a continuation for an additional 20 years of a program that's already been operating for the last 25. And so there is clearly more land to be protected in Sarasota County, and without this program's continuation, we don't have the ability to protect those additional acres, either through conservation or fee simple purchases. And this applies not only to the environmental lands, but also to park lands. So without these programs in place, there's no funding coming in to purchase and protect the land, nor any funding coming in to help manage and operate the properties.
So on the ballot in November, and I think the early voting starts a couple of weeks earlier, there are going to be two ballot measures, not just one. And one is to authorize the program to continue with this quarter mil that if you've been paying land taxes in Sarasota County, you've been paying it for a quarter century. But talk about the other referendum that's going to be on the ballot related to this.
So the other question on the ballot will be to allow the county to bond up to $250 million, which is what was on the ballot in 2005 for both programs. So it's essentially a repeat ballot initiative, and we're hoping that it will pass as well as it did in 2005 with 80% majority vote.
Yeah, what I like about this is that bonding is essentially like a mortgage. You get to use the property immediately, but you pay for it over time, which means people that move here 5 years from now get to help pay for it. It doesn't fall all on current citizenry.
Yes, we cannot rely solely on the ad valorem taxes. Without the bonds, it limits us from being able to make
And it's pay as you go, and if you don't have much money in your account, you can't buy, you know, even buying the conservation easement on the Hawkins Ranch is going to be tremendously expensive.
Yes.
Yeah, on that many acres. So what if this doesn't, these two items don't pass in November, but what are the implications for Sarasota County if it doesn't pass?
Well, if it doesn't pass until 2006, we have another shot at it in 2028.
Okay.
So keep that in mind.
Right.
The current program doesn't sunset until December of 29. So we do have a few years. And we do have a backup plan, but keep in mind that once December 2029 rolls around, if neither measures have passed successfully, the program will likely sunset, and funding the management of the properties will certainly be a challenge. We also are required to pay any remaining debt services from past bonds, and that will sunset December 29 too. So any program funding coming in 28, 29 would need to be applied towards that debt service. So without this funding, it means no more future purchases from Sarasota County unless it's done 100% through other funding sources.
Yeah. It's really a great program for landowners because when families find themselves in a situation where they want or need to cease ranching or whatever their operation is, it's really nice that they have a choice. Without programs like this, the only real final crop is asphalt and shingles and stuff. And so to be able to go to a landowner and say, we're paying fair market value. And the thing that impressed me, when we started this program, we didn't know if it's a willing seller program. There's no condemnation, there's no eminent domain. So the county only buys land from people willing to sell. So the citizens authorized the program, but we had no way of knowing if anyone would sell properties to us. And we've now, in the Environmental Lands Program alone, have acquired 100 properties. 101 properties. So when you've made 101 purchases, it's a pretty fair indication that you're offering people a reasonable amount of money. Why don't we see if there are questions either for Lee or Bree. Either we can repeat the question or Julie can get a little closer to you. Yeah.
I actually have a question.
Go ahead.
Will the referendum, either of them, allow for the county to buy a conservation easement, not in partnership with North Carolina Lands or the Ford Forever Program, and negotiate that so that there could be public access? Will that give you the ability to buy conservation easements with different terms and allow public access, etc.?
Sure, that's a good question. The question was, does the county have other partners that we can work with to protect land through conservation easements other than Boulder Forever or Rural Family Land? And can we consider the allowance of public access and recreation on those properties? So the answer is yes and yes. There are other partners out there. As I mentioned earlier, we have partnered with Swiftblood to do conservation easements. There's also the NRCS that has the agricultural land easements. There are a number of different types of easements, both federal and state, that we can partner with agencies on to protect rural lands particularly. As far as the public access, that can occur. It really is up to the property owner as to whether or not they want that liability, and that's what it essentially comes down to. What we have been successful at doing with two conservation easements is that the landowners have negotiated what's called recreational trail easements that cross over a portion of their property, which means that the public can utilize that portion of the property once the trails are put in place, but it doesn't mean that they have rights to access the entire property.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for your excellent commentary. You guys are wonderful. I have a very quick question. How are the landowners compensated for these types of agreements? Is it a check you write? Is it a long-term contract? How does the payment happen?
It's pretty much done through a wire transfer. So the question was how are...
At one time.
How are the landowners compensated for the purchase of the conservation easement? It's a closing where they're paid at the time of closing. It's not a long-term payout over time, so it's a one-time payment. And the landowners... a lot of them put that money back into the land to help manage their land and to make improvements on the land. And the requirements with their conservation easement that the property is documented using a baseline inventory report, which is basically a snapshot in time of the conditions of the property. The property owners are required to maintain the property in that same condition or even better. And a lot of property owners that look at opportunities on how to enhance native habitat, do hydrological restorations, remove exotics, and continue to maintain and manage the land in its natural setting.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, the county acquires a conservation easement on a ranch 20 years from now. The ranch owners, the family decide they want to get out of ranching. Now they need to find a buyer. They cannot sell it to a development company because the development rights have been extinguished. So their choices are to find someone else that would like to operate a ranch in Sarasota County or sell the remaining rights to the public, in which case it would become a park and become open to the public. Is that fair?
Yes. So the question was if a property owner wants to sell their property, who can they sell to? So they can actually sell to whoever they want. It's how that future buyer uses the property.
Right.
So it could be that it's another cattle rancher. It could be someone who just wants open space, peace, and quiet, and doesn't have any interest in doing cattle ranching. They still do need to maintain the property. And if they wanted to, they could sell the property to the county for county fee ownership. And the county would basically pay the difference in price between the fair market value and the conservation easement. In fact, when we do negotiate conservation easements, we often ask that the property owner consider the county with a first right of refusal in case the county would like to buy the purchase.
Great. Great. Go ahead.
I have two quick questions. The first, does Manatee do this as well? Is there another count for Manatee? Or is,
yes. Yeah. Manatee passed a referendum in 2020.
And then the second is, I'm new to Sarasota. Has there any of the 101 properties, has anything been done on this side of 75 rather than on the Lakewood side of 75?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. There are a lot of urban parks. In fact, one of our favorites is Red Bug Sleep Reserve.
Is what?
Red Bug Sleep Reserve,
okay.
Which is just north of Clark Road and off of Geneva.
Yeah, you can go online and there's a map of all the, what web page would you direct people to?
SarasotaCountyParks.com.
Yeah, so there's a map of not only all the county parks, but all these preserves and neighborhood parks as well. Yeah.
Well, after an easement is in place, I assume that lowers the assessed value of the property. Would then the landowner pay less taxes?
Yes, the landowner does pay less taxes.
So that's another incentive.
It is another incentive, yeah. So the question was, with Sarasota County's conservation easements, there are annual site inspections, which are called monitoring site visits. Does the state's rural and family lands protection program also monitor and enforce the conservation easements? And the answer is yes, the state does. They do theirs biannually, and they typically do that in conjunction with whatever agency they've partnered with, whether it's Sarasota County or another county or Swift Mud. In the case of the ones that Sarasota County is negotiating with rural family lands, because we are contributing to the purchase and will be title holders, we've also asked that we participate in those monitoring visits. And one of the great ways of doing that is establishing relationships with the landowners, becoming partners with them so that everybody benefits, not just the landowner, but the public and also the county as a funding source.
Maynard's got a question.
Question was, will we be developing plans that would allow for environmental infrastructure on lands we purchase and protect? And then the second question was, do we have the ability to transfer development rights off of properties that we've purchased to apply them towards other uses or greenways? So the first question, we have what are called work plans within protection priority sites. The Sarasota County Commission approves a protection priority site, which is basically a polygon of land that has willing sellers and habitat that we'd like to protect. And when they approve that protection priority site, they're also approving the work plan that goes with it that helps us identify the different properties and the steps and stages in which we should acquire them and who our partners will be. We don't typically look at implementing environmental infrastructure into properties unless there's a hydrological issue, such as at Deer Prairie Creek with dams, or there's weirs that need to be replaced, such as in Red Bug Slough Preserve. Some of those infrastructure projects are done through things like public works or stormwater, and not through our parks departments. So, and even sometimes done by third parties, such as Swift Mud. So we don't plan for the infrastructure unless it's something that's clearly needed on a property that we're acquiring, where we see there's an issue that needs to be addressed. As far as the question goes with TDRs, we actually established a TDR bank back in the early 2000s, and certain properties in Sarasota County, TDRs are the transferable development rights. So TDRs, sometimes developers don't have enough to be able to develop their property, and they'll be looking for ways to acquire additional dwelling units, and they'll purchase development rights to add to their property. In Sarasota County, we've stripped development rights off of our properties, not all of them, but quite a few of them, and they had to be outside of the urban service boundary. They had to have certain types of habitat and X number of units, and dollar values were placed on each of those units, and they were put into a bank where individuals could purchase those development rights to apply to their property, but it had to be a reciprocal sending site for a reciprocal receiving site. This happens occasionally in the private sector. Back in the early 2000s, when people were looking for development rights, didn't have enough, they didn't have any sources to go to in the private sector, and that's when they came to the county and said, you've bought all these thousands of acres, you don't have any plan of ever developing them, could you set aside development rights for sale or purchase? And so we have done that with a number of our properties. And the nice thing about the development rights when they do sell, the revenue generated from the sale of those development rights comes back into the program, and they can be used to apply towards other.
And Maynard, to speak to your analogy and analog to the Legacy Trail, we're trying to get some synergy by creating connectivity between these sites that we've acquired. So Right now, south of I-75, we have Sleeping Turtle South, and north of it, there's regular Sleeping Turtles. But in between, there's an interstate highway and a waterway and a parcel of land that the county doesn't control. And so, ultimately, if we could acquire a portion of the former I-75 rest area, when you're about to cross the Mack River on I-75, you go over a different kind of pavement. And what's going on there is that there's an underpass for high water flow in the Mack River. When the Mack comes out of its banks, part of the flow can go under the interstate. So for 95% of the year, people could walk under the interstate. So you could start at Snookhaven, or ultimately, if we get the Southern 65 property, start at the Chokes Preserve, walk up under the interstate, cross the former I-75 rest area over a bridge that has to be built, get to the Sleeping Turtles, and eventually end up in Manatee County somewhere, or Crowley Nature Center. So right now, there's a certain amount of value in having separate and distinct parcels that are protected, but that all gets multiplied when we're able to make additional connections. Other questions?
The question was, how are properties selected? That's a great question. We have a nomination process, and there's a QR code on that pop-up screen over there that you can scan to get the nomination form. If a nomination is for a property that's already in a protection priority site, it means that that property at one point was determined to have a willing seller, and we can, if they are ready to sell, we can begin the process to move forward with an acquisition. If it's not in the protection priority site, we can do a review of the property, which goes to our advisory board, which is the Environmental Assets of Land Oversight Committee. The review occurs, and we have a number of attributes that we review and consider. And then it can either be added to an existing protection priority site if it passes the review, or it can be established into a new protection priority site, which requires board authorization and approval for that new site and a protection plan with a work plan. So citizens can nominate any property. They don't have to be the property owner. They can nominate their neighbor's property. They can nominate a property they drive by. They don't have to notify the owner. County does the research and the legwork to determine if that property owner is a willing seller. And if it meets the criteria, then it can be considered for acquisition.
And willing seller in this case is a sort of term of art. It doesn't mean the property is listed with a realtor. It means they'd be willing to have a conversation with the county about possibly selling. So they don't have to be actively trying to unload the property. They just have to be open to it. County doesn't want to put people in a position of feeling like they're trying to take their land if they're not interested in selling. So there's some great parcels out there that would be great to own, but the owners are not interested in talking, so we don't push it. And sometimes they come around.
What's the minimum size property that would be considered?
There is no minimum.
We buy dock lots, right?
We buy dock lots that are 0.01. Typically, those are funded through impact fees, but we have bought small parcels, especially when they daisy chain, when they connect. And so the goal is to try and connect a series of properties together. So oftentimes we'll get a handful of willing sellers for five properties that are all adjacent to each other, and we'll negotiate all five of those at once.
Explain what a dock lot is.
So down in Nokomis off of Shackett Creek, there are a lot of property owners in East Nokomis that live, that don't live on the water, but they were granted lots that access canals. And they are very small properties that cannot be built on, but can give them water access. A lot of these property owners have found that they don't utilize that property, and they see that a park is adjacent to it, and that the park would benefit from those dock lots. So we've been slowly acquiring those. We started with 35, and we now have 17 lots to acquire. So if you know anyone who owns a dock lot in Columbus, let me know.
So historically, when the program first started, it was just focused on environmental lands, and we ended up with citizens were nominating sites that were really intriguing, interesting sites, but they didn't meet the criteria for environmental land. And so that's what led to the creation of the Neighborhood Parkland Program. And in fact, there's sites that we acquired through the environmental lands program, like Redbud Slough, that if we'd had a neighborhood parkland program when we first started, we probably would have considered Red Bug Slough on Beneva Road a neighborhood park rather than a classic, you know, nature preserve. And so we actually went back and sort of rejiggered the boundaries so that there's now, I guess, a playground, is that right? So
it's split in half.
Yeah.
Half of it is environmental, half of it neighborhood park.
So there's individual lots on Warm Mineral Spring Run.
That's right.
That are important for manatees in the warm water from Warm Mineral Springs are important for manatees, and they have a nursery there, right? Yep.
So the Warm Mineral Springs Creek is a winter refuge location for manatees, and we partnered with Florida Fish and Wildlife to establish that as a protection priority site. There were originally 36 lots that we set a goal to acquire. We've acquired 19 of those so far. Those we do not advertise and promote for public access. In fact, the work that we do along there is to help stabilize the shoreline, remove the exotic vegetation. Over time, the shorelines have started to erode, and that sediment buildup in the creek has damaged the habitat and seagrass, well, the foliage that the manatee eats, and it also has caused the water depths to have issues as well. So FWC has recently done, I wouldn't call it a dredging project, but a restoration project to help restore creek bottom. But those shoreline protected corridors are vital for the protection of the manatee during those winter months.
Yeah, the county commission's been pretty assistant over the years of providing at least rudimentary public access to the properties we acquire. But there are occasions where we would acquire something and not make it particularly accessible to protect the resource. Yeah.
Any questions for Lee?
The question was, are any of the longleaf pines that we're working with maybe more salt tolerant than other longleaf pine populations? I don't know the answer, but I can tell you, you know, on Pine Island in Lee County that these pines were completely inundated by Hurricane Ian under 3 feet of water. I don't know how another pine, you know, longleaf might have fared. These certainly survived. We did soil tests through the area afterwards and found no salinity in the soil. So I think maybe all the rains ahead of time maybe super saturated the soil. They just really couldn't penetrate. But I don't know what really happened there. We had a top burn of vegetation, but basically everything survived the inundation just fine. And I couldn't tell you if there's a genetic component to that survival or not.
Embracing Our Differences, a local nonprofit celebrating individuality and shared humanity through art and education, is now accepting art and quotation submissions for the 2027 Embracing Our Differences exhibition. Artists and writers from around the world are invited to submit original artwork and or quotations that inspire kindness, respect, and understanding. Submissions are permitted by both students and adults, as well as both amateurs and professionals. Deadline to apply is July 1st. More information is available at embracingourdifferences.org.
Yeah, the question was, just to say a few things about red cockaded woodpeckers in relation to longleaf pines. So that's a federally endangered species, a woodpecker. I think the nearest population is in Babcock Webb. I think Duet Preserve in time could support red cockaded woodpeckers, but that would be years down the line, like decades down the line, unless they were to install artificial nesting boxes and manually translocate birds to that property. But red-cockaded woodpeckers need really specific habitat conditions, really well-managed land. And the main thing is that they naturally nest in longleaf pine trees that are old enough to develop a rot inside of the heartwood that makes it hollow inside, so like the woodpecker can drill and create a cavity, a nesting cavity inside of that old tree. Where we have young trees like Duet Preserve, historically longleaf pine, they clear cut that. So what we have today are young trees, and it's just going to take decades for the trees to get old enough to support RCW's red-cockaded woodpeckers naturally. So they'll take a chainsaw and cut a hole in the tree, a young tree, and stick a box inside of it. And that's how they did that at Babcock Webb and other areas to bring the population back on a faster timeline. So the question was to say something about the status of bark beetles and the death of pine trees in our area. You know, my perception of this is most of the time we're actually getting slash pine death from hurricane mechanical wind damage. And so the tree's getting stressed and the pine bark beetles are coming in after the fact. And you see after, you know, Ian and Hurricane Milton, tons of tree mortality. And I chalk it up to the wind damage and not the pine bark beetle. And you can actually go on to the University of Florida IFAS website and find a guide for identifying beetle types. And so most of the times the beetles that you find are the beetles that attack after the fact. They're kind of the cleanup crew, not the pathogenic beetle.
You talked about creating a market for growing longleaf pine seedlings, and that sounds great. Is there a market for the herbaceous layer? Are there seed collection efforts? How are you establishing the ground cover, the diversity in those forests?
Thank you. So the ground cover diversity is really where the magic happens. You know, so much of the value for wildlife is in the ground cover. Unfortunately, it's really very expensive and hard to restore ground cover. So just kind of like rough numbers, you know, you would spend, I don't know, like 100 times as much money restoring ground cover versus planting the canopy pine. So it's a tremendous need because it's very important, but logistically and economically, it's very difficult. So oftentimes, people are having to settle for less good ground cover and hope that it develops in time. But it is a major need, and people are growing significant quantities of ground cover species. Wiregrass is often the kind of considered the keystone ground cover there, and you can buy that in mass quantities from native growers for restoration.
My understanding is that the law changed, and that when we had the previous referenda to protect land in the county could proactively print material and go out, and staff members could tell the public how to vote, and that the law has been changed in Tallahassee, and that the county is no longer able to print brochures advocating passage, that if citizens or groups would like the county to come give a presentation, that's possible. So could you explain how they would go about doing that?
Sure. So, yes, there was a law passed by the state that prohibits local governments for advocating and educating about the referendums once the ballot language has been approved. Our ballot language was approved by the county commission back in April. So the only way for us to be able to educate the public about aspects of the referendum is when it's been solicited, such as being requested to attend an event to speak about it. So a way you can go about doing that is you can contact our office, and you can call the contact center by 311 or 861-5000 and request. If you have a civic group or a homeowners association, staff can certainly go out to present to your organization or club or group, whatever. You can also attend our advisory board meetings. We have two citizens advisory boards. One is the Parks Parks Advisory and Recreation Council, PARC, and then SBOC, our Environmental Assistance Lands Oversight Committee. And then there's also a PAC that has been formed called Sarasota County Forever that also is advocating for the referendum. And they can do that because they are.
Yes, if you're interested in Sarasota County Forever, you can write to them at sarasotacountyforever@gmail.com. You've been listening to our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show number 88 was pre-recorded and featured Lee Amos talking about the challenges of land management and Bree Anderson talking about Sarasota County's successful land acquisition and management program and the upcoming referenda.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment.
Tune in at 9 next week for more Healthy Living Hour with Dr. Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on June 9th for the next episode of our Changing Environment.
We want to thank Selby Gardens and the Saranoa chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society for creating this opportunity.
And WSLR station manager Leon Kerber for making this remote recording possible. And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events